Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Ayla Cuenca. Ayla is a holistic birth guide, childbirth educator, doula, health freedom advocate, and birth trauma alchemist. She holds a BA in anthropology and ethnographic photography from Bennington College. After working as a documentary photographer, she became specialized as a birth educator and doula. She stands behind the idea that it is everyone's right to have access to empowering education from conception to parenting. Her work is dedicated to offering guidance that supports women and men in the process that is a return to their deepest knowing about birth, individual sovereignty, and the body's innate intelligence. I've been wanting to reach out to Ayla for many years, so I'm extremely happy that we've had the chance to talk. Birth is something that has been almost completely co-opted by the centralized medical establishment. It has become a sterile, robotic and soulless procedure where the agency is deliberately taken away from the mother through instilling fear and mistrust of the body's innate intelligence. Both myself and Ayla hope that young women are educated properly about birth so that they can make informed decisions about how they can approach it with reverence and trust. It is vital that we prioritize birthing practices that are conducive to the health of the newborns. Something the sterile, artificially lit, pharmaceutical-fueled, and non-native EMF-dense hospital settings fail to account for. With all this being said, I really hope you enjoy the episode. Ayla, thank you for giving me some of your time. I've really been looking forward to this. This is a little bit outside the scope of what I'm knowledgeable about, so I'm really looking forward to getting to dig deep and ask you some questions and get a deeper understanding as to what your expertise is.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm glad that we connected, and I'm happy to be here and go wherever we may go.
Awesome. So I think a good place to start might be, you know, what it is that you do, what is a doula, and how you got into this position in the first place.
Yeah, so I actually used to work for the 11th Judicial Circuit in Florida, in Miami, as a guardian ad litem. So I was responsible for checking in on different foster children and writing reports and relaying that back to the judge and to the attorneys. And in that work was when I started to see that there was this huge deficit. Like, everyone was always talking about solutions for how to fix, you know, this, I don't know, broken family issue that we're all contending with, right? Across the country and many parts of the world, but particularly here in the United States, it's like, how do we find supportive, healthy homes for children, you know? And we need more funding. And I was like, this goes back further than that. Like, there's something more broken than just figuring out how to get more funding for foster parents and more resources, you know? And so, in my attempt to kind of reverse engineer how we landed at this point, I started to kind of get called into the birth space, you know, and see, oh, well, if there was more, you know, capacity and opportunity for intentional conception and preparing for this rite of passage and understanding this rite of passage differently, you know, this could start to shift. And people think, oh, that's like a really privileged way to look at it, right? There's always this like default that it's like, oh, to have capacity to be intentional and to conceive intentionally is a privilege. I'm like, I think it's everyone's right to be able to have the spaciousness to conceive intentionally. That starts with even educating little girls about their bodies so that they make different choices regardless of what's happening in the world, you know, and honor their bodies. And so it's a holistic perspective on something where it's educating children, you know, boys and girls, teenagers, you know, desexualizing birth, desexualizing this whole world and looking at it as a sacred gift, a sacred rite of passage. And so that's how I got into birth work and birth education. And now spend a lot of energy and intention working in birth trauma and how so many women are reeling from this experience and they don't know how to process it. So creating a space for that so that they can move forward into more intentional parenting, connected experiences with their partners or husbands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason I've become so interested and a little bit passionate about changing the way that we look at conceiving and birth is because my mother and I almost died during childbirth. It was a very traumatic experience. And we got away with it by the skin of our teeth. And ever since then, I've sort of been looking back at that going, how did that go so wrong? And, you know, what could have been done to actually make that process, you know, a normal birthing process? And it makes you think, well, what really is a natural birth from the perspective of our species? And I remember reading a book where a microbiome researcher was in the rainforest in South America, and he watched a mother give birth. She went out there with her mother and she squatted over a banana leaf, and the whole process was over very short. And, you know, the baby was in the dirt, you know, and they picked him up and everything was fine. And that couldn't be more contrasted with what we experience now. You know, I think in Australia, a third of births are planned C-sections. So it couldn't be more different to what, you know, I think we're supposed to be, you know, aiming for as a species. And, you know, from your perspective, I suspect this is what you're trying to sort of get back to is put natural birth back where it should be, and give mothers the choice to do that, and not have them scared, so scared that they feel like they need to do an emergency C-section.
Right, because what's happening, this is a great point that you bring up, what's happening is that women believe they have choices, where it's like, go to the hospital and like either get an induction or go into labor naturally. Like, those are my choices.
Yeah.
Right? They believe that that's a choice, and that's just one fragment of the experience that's possible for them. So, yeah, it's about showing them what has been done, right? And a lot of people might say, well, you know, we're in such a better place now. We have all this technology and we know how to cure disease. And I'm like, are we really curing diseases? Or are we just suppressing them and delaying the inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. Through this like illusion of mitigation. So it's about showing women how it was done and how simple it can be, because we really have gotten to a point where we feel like it's so complicated that we require all of this intervention and we require all of the technology. And without it, we are in this like wild, unsafe place, you know? And so when we look at how it was done, we look at what's possible, we look at the options and how straightforward the process really is, then women really do see their choices at that point. And I'm a firm believer. I've seen it with my own eyes over the last decade. Like, the more we add interventions, the more complicated it becomes.
Yeah.
It's just the formula.
And from your point of view, what are the... I mean, obviously, there are some benefits to having the hospital there and you know, being able to be in that place where there are those drastic interventions if something went wrong. But, you know, the vast majority of people... should not need that. And from your point of view, what are the fallbacks? What are the pitfalls of you know, doing it the conventional way? You know, we're planning, you go into the hospital, you're in this really strange sort of environment where, you know, the lights stay the same all the time. It's very sterile. You know, they cut the cord straight away. You know, there's all these things that are quite different. You know, what do you think this... what do you think the potential negatives of doing that really are? And how do you explain that to expecting mothers?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, we started intervening in birth, like, let's say 1880s was when we started inviting the male physician into the birth space. And slowly, midwives were being edged out. And then we started birthing in hospitals in the 1890s. And then by the 1940s, 50% of women were birthing in hospitals. And this is where we started. This was the beginning of what Dr. Bradley calls the knock them out, drag them out era of birth, where you knock the mother out and drag the baby out, basically. Yeah. And it was being advertised that way, like, you can feel no pain, right? It's, you know, take this chloroform, just breathe in the chloroform, and you'll wake up and you'll have a baby. And guess what? We'll clean the baby for you. We'll feed the baby for you. We have this thing called formula. And you don't have to have this whole mess at home, and you'll be really safe, because if anything could go wrong, which the biggest concern at that time was infection postpartum and hemorrhage. Those are the biggest concerns, but we have to look at how we left villages and we left rural settings, and we started bringing these home birth practices into cities, cramped conditions, right? Like London and New York, where it was not comfortable and safe to have a home birth. There were like 10 people living in a one-bedroom tenement, you know, with no running water. And so the conditions were not supportive of birth in general. So of course it became dangerous to home birth.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not because home birth is inherently dangerous. And so we started intervening and it just became commonplace. And then, you know, 1940s until now, it's like we've been really deep in that sleep of believing that the more technology we have, the safer we are. It's just a technocratic way of viewing birth, this human experience, you know, separating the soul from the body. And I'll tell you, it's C-section rates are only going up, right? So if we're really safer, then why are we having so many more C-sections? And it's just growing and growing over time. You know, why are we having more babies in trouble? That's the big question I ask, if it's really safer to be in the hospital than ever before, you know. And so a woman even choosing to birth in the hospital, to choose to work with a doctor when she's healthy, low risk, you know, even that choice is already going to take her down a path of intervention, right? A lot of testing in the pregnancy, which has a lot of psychological effects on the woman, right? Which can manifest as physical issues if she's not able to manage and, you know, filter out what's being given to her, because it's very fear-based, the way that women are tested in their pregnancy, especially in this country, you know, and I'm sure in Australia it's similar. So, yeah, just the choice to work, to step into the conventional field is already the beginning of what I consider a cascade of events that lead to C-sections, emergency C-sections.
Yeah.
You know, where a woman is then convinced, you know, thank God I was in the hospital because, you know, I had this emergency. But no one ever sits there to, again, reverse engineer how she got there.
Yeah.
You know, and if we're looking at true need, true emergencies, situations where women would benefit from being in that space with technology and high intervention, the numbers are very, very low. They're quite low for who actually requires that. But 99% of women in the United States, for example, are birthing in hospitals. I know, like, maybe you and I are, like, in these circles of people where it's like we're in an echo chamber of people who are, you know, into natural birth and looking at alternative health, you know. But it's really not the majority of the world, you know. You might think it is, but it's not.
So how do you have the conversation with women who are probably understandably concerned that something might go wrong, and if they're at home, then that could lead to something, you know, really not so favorable outcomes. How do you, you know, sort of talk them through that and really lay out the risk, the cost benefit analysis, and sort of stake your claim as to why doing it in a safer, well, in a more comfortable, you know, environment like their home, doing the type of birthing that you do.
Well, it's education. Most women who have these fears don't actually understand how birth works. They, you know, they think, well, I'm pregnant. Of course, like, I know I'm pregnant and this is like my realm now. But really, they've been educated usually by women and their families who didn't have positive birth experiences, who had highly medicalized births. And then they're also educated by Hollywood, what they see in movies. And so they don't actually know how this process works, and they've actually never really been taught much about their bodies. Mm-hmm. Most women who have body literacy are not so fear-based and don't believe that the hospital is the safest place to be. So when a woman's not been, she's been disembodied, I'd like to say, you know, in that way, she's going to believe that it's safer to be there and that, you know, home birth is dangerous. So it's about kind of deprogramming the way that she's been introduced to birth and this whole, you know, initiation, and then offering actual education on how the process works, and explaining how she's actually safer at home. And then really looking at the existential fear that exists in most of us, right, in varying degrees. And that's what it is just not trusting this process. And, you know, there are some women who are quite neurotic, you know, when it comes to their environment, their health, this process. Now, there's a lot of control that they're trying to exert onto their environment, and that's a deeper issue. You know, the control is a trauma response, and so sometimes we go pretty deep into like what the motivation is, and they'll say, you know, I just want to have a connected, peaceful experience, and I'm like, well, this is not the way to do it. So it's not about wrong or right. I'm not going to say like it's wrong to go to the hospital, it's right to go to do a home birth, but there are consequences to each choice. And so you have to evaluate the consequences. And that's where you make the decision.
And I feel like a lot of people aren't adequately informed to make that decision in the first place. And I think that's where you're right. Education is so important, because if everyone was adequately educated, perhaps they wouldn't be choosing the hospital like sort of reflexively, just because of the fear-based thought that surrounds, you know, what could go wrong. So what is a, I guess I don't want to use the word standard, because I'm sure it's extremely individualized for each person that you work with. But what is the process that you prefer to work with as far as your home birthing style?
I mean, I would say I really enjoy working with women who are curious about the experience. So they're like very open and receptive and curious about where the experience will take them, right? And they're trusting. So I can't say there's like a particular formula, more so than how receptive she is. And I've noticed a lot of women, you know, do run into the challenge of being receptive to their environment. You know, again, it's just this desire to exert a lot of control, you know, and so she doesn't feel safe, right, in her environment in general, like in her world. She doesn't feel quite safe. And so that is a challenging type of client to work with, I would say. I enjoy working with clients who have, you know, good communication with their husbands. You know, when I step into certain dynamics, I can see that there is like a lot of communication breakdown between the woman and her partner, and that can make it challenging. You know, it's a journey to go on together. And the husband has a very, very important role in this process. And they themselves have an initiation to go through. And it's really empowering, you know, because men really just don't, as I'm sure you know, like there are not many initiations, if any, that men have going from boy to man, right? And so typically this can be one. You know, we think going to university is like an initiation, right? But if we go back a little bit further, like when they're about 11 or 12, boys, you know, they'll do like Aborigines, you know, which you might be familiar with, like they have their walkabout, they have a rite of passage, they have a ceremony, you know, they have to go out into the environment, they have to prove certain things to themselves, you know, and boys just don't really have that. And we have, you know, this is why we get lost, you know, as the youth, we don't have a place to put this. And even when girls begin to menstruate, a lot of women are like, you know, with their daughters, they don't even know what to do. They're just like, okay, this is going to happen every month. It's really inconvenient. And this is how you deal with it. And, you know, don't get pregnant, right? It's like this really kind of harsh, disconnected conversation, if there's even a conversation. And there's a lot of shame woven into it. And so I would say what I find is men and women both come up with, you know, against the birth experience, they encounter it as their first initiation into something big, into their manhood or their womanhood. And so when we're disconnected, we don't take that opportunity. And so I see sometimes men kind of missing out. Men have so much responsibility in society. Like when I look at the collective, it's like, I see it. It's like, they feel so much pressure to perform. So, you know, men, this is what I perceive, so much pressure to perform and to please, and so much weight on their backs, and not enough direction, you know, and not enough support from women. And women are looking at men like, I don't have support from you. And there's this kind of like resentment in the collective. You know, and so this can be a really healing process for the man and the woman if they can step into their power and not hand it over to a system that completely strips them both of their power.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I want to dig into this, you know, what is the role of the father? Because I think a lot of time it's sort of just completely ignored. You know, there is no role of the father. It's just the woman doing everything. But obviously not just, you know, emotional support and care, even preconception, which I'd love to get into as well. But, you know, it's not something that should be done alone. And even if there is someone like yourself there guiding, I think a masculine presence there to support as well is very important. And what do you see as the role of the father in all of this, even from preconception through to birth and even beyond?
Yeah, so I'm really big on this concept of containment, which I learned from one of my teachers, Om Rupani. And so he works a lot in the masculine-feminine dynamic and really like tapping in, tuning in to feel it and to work with it in everyday life. And so as I started to understand containment, which is basically creating this container for the other person, right? So like, we do it all the time, right? Like you're hosting me in this conversation, you're creating the container for me to express and share, and you've created a framework, we have a time frame for it, you're asking the questions, you're containing me now, you know? And so when we can just become cognizant of that power and that dance, so much can happen, right? So when a man and a woman in their conception journey can become cognizant of that, then the man can see, wow, I really do have an equally important role in this process, because she's doing this, you know, she's going through this physical transformation. And what can I do so that she can move through that without having to be so much in her head, right? Like she can tell me, this is what I want to do. And I can, and then the man can, you know, provide the opportunity for her to get that, you know? And I see this a lot with women because I, you know, kind of watch them as they interact with their partner, and it's like correcting him, telling him what to do. You know, it's sometimes it's not good enough, and, you know, telling him it's not good enough in front of other people, and really that kind of like dark mommy energy, right? And, you know, the man is set up for failure. He can't win, right? Because she doesn't really express what she needs. And then when he doesn't do the thing, she gets angry. But it's like, how did he know he was supposed to do the thing when you never expressed the need for the thing? You know, like assuming that a man is a mind reader, right? And so when we can start to kind of like clean up those dynamics, be really aware, and it's quite simple, you know, then the man really does see his role, she sees her role, and it's not about him being in the birth room at the end of the day and catching the baby, unless that's really what he wants to do. I don't know that men have like a role in the birth room per se, and historically they really didn't. It was a group of women, you know, women who knew about birth, family members who understood birth, and back then everybody knew about birth, like historically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone understood, all women understood birth. It wasn't like a specialized person who, you know, they did have wise women and medicine women and midwives, but everyone in the room had seen a birth. So, you know, they could always support the woman, and the man was making sure that, you know, there was food and provisions and the perimeter was protected and there was no one coming to cause harm. So what happens when we go into a hospital room is there's a bunch of strangers poking and prodding the woman, because it's nurses, it's not the doctor she's gotten to know, if she's even gotten to know the doctor over the course of her pregnancy. Sometimes it's the backup doctor they've never met. So he can't really protect her or offer any kind of container for her in that experience, because he has no power. She has no power. And so that event in and of itself can create a huge rift in their relationship. This is why a lot of people say, like, we, you know, our relationship really went downhill after the birth. They blame it on the baby, but it's actually so much about that lack of containment. And then the birth compounds that. It really exposes it, and the woman feels betrayed. She didn't feel held. She didn't feel secure. But the man didn't know any better, you know, because they're in an environment that doesn't support that dynamic. So I would say that when the man can offer her that holding, you know, and allow her to relax and surrender, she can really receive the guidance. She can really receive his support. And he feels really good, because he feels he has, you know, he can take action, he can take direction. You know, he has a direction in mind. He says, oh, she told me she needs that. How do I get her that? And then he provides that, and then she feels happy. And then everybody feels satisfied, you know. So
all comes back to trust and communication in the end.
Yeah. Mm. And there's a great book by Laura Doyle called The Empowered Wife. It was called The Surrendered Wife. It's called The Empowered Wife. No, it's a new version. And there's really great tools in that book for a woman to basically shift the way she's approaching her man. And you get different results. You don't have to change him because he's predisposed to wanting to provide and please. And so when the opportunity is actually created, he will do it. And some women say, oh, it's been years since, you know, he's given an effort in this direction. He just needs to wake up, right? But actually, if she were to create the conditions in herself to receive it and change her language, he would just do it. It's so there underneath the surface, you know? And I have a great trick that I always give my clients just as a practice run so that their dynamic can shift a little bit and see what happens. I give them a little bit of homework throughout the pregnancy from time to time. And I say, okay, if he's trying to decide between, you know, purchasing the green car or the blue car, right? And he says, hey, to his wife, hey, what do you think? I don't know. Should I get the green car and the blue car? Rather than being the woman who knows all the answers and can solve all the problems and is so good, why don't you just say, I don't know, babe, what do you think? Right? And he says, oh, I have an opportunity now to solve the problem. And he'll do what he thinks is best. You know, he'll say, yeah, you know, actually, I think the blue car is better for me. And all she has to say is, great, sounds good, right? So when you give them the opportunity to solve the problem, they will. But when you're like, oh, well, the green car gets better mileage, but the blue car has it, and then the green, then you've disabled him from being able to take direction and action in his own right. And so that simple exercise of like when he asks for her opinion, he's used to asking for her opinion because, you know, he feels that if he doesn't ask for her opinion, he's going to get in trouble. So when he asks, just say, what do you think? Not what do you want, whatever you want. Say, whatever you think. What do you think is best? And they'll start to see a huge change in the way that they relate and communicate to one another.
Mm-hmm. How early do you normally get involved in the process? Are people usually contacting you preconception and then working with you from there?
Yeah, I would say that's primarily the way it works now. I do get contacted by women in their pregnancy, midway through or in the beginning, even sometimes towards the end. But now primarily it's a lot of women who are in the process of conceiving and want to start stepping into that consciously in a different way. Mm-hmm. And the pregnancy goes by quite fast. You know, it's a really fast 10 months, and so to have that inspiration to start seeking out support and educating yourself early, even if it's like a year out, you know, like the education is so, I mean, this education should exist when we're young girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what are things that you think should be prioritized in this preconception phase? Obviously, I mean, from my point of view, nutrition is a very important component because obviously what's happening is a massive draw on the woman's body, and it's very, very difficult to keep up with the just the nutritional side of thing to actually grow a little person inside of you. But are there any other things that need to be sort of prioritized leading up to conception?
Yeah, I would say the woman's relationship to herself is like the primary thing to focus on. Like you said, nutrition, of course. And that in itself can unlock a lot about a woman's relationship to herself.
Exactly.
Just reevaluating her relationship to food. But what I mean by this is a lot of women have experienced trauma. Most of us have, right? One in three children are sexually abused, and that's just what's reported. And so we know we grow up and we want to create life and we want to have children. We've been functioning in a way as a response to that trauma, which means most of us have left the building, right? Most of us are not really in our bodies as a way to exist in the world. Coming back into the body would be to feel too much. It would be too much of a recognition of those unwanted events and experiences. And so, unfortunately, if we don't address this, then it does come up during the birth. It can definitely come up during the actual birth process, where a woman won't even dilate in labor because her body is still in a state of survival. Because the body doesn't experience time the way that the mind does. The mind experiences time in a linear fashion. And the body is like, it doesn't matter if it was 30 years ago. If I'm reminded of it, it feels like it's happening to me right in this moment.
Yeah.
So the somatic experience is, you know, we don't understand the somatic experience collectively. And so, say, as a woman reevaluates her relationship to herself, this is where we can do that work to become embodied, to integrate those parts of us that have splintered off over the years at various junctures when things happened and they weren't resolved. And so this will also make us better mothers, right? Because when we can expand that capacity to hold this, when we feel the safety in our own body, when we're actually in our body and we're not disassociating, we're not auto-regulating with, you know, addictions like vaping and scrolling and, you know, needing to be engaged constantly, stimulated so that we're not feeling. Like when we let all of that go and we're in our bodies, we're able to actually hold space for a child. And so some women, you know, they'll go through the birth smoothly perhaps, and then they get hit with the consequences of not reconnecting with their bodies when their child's, you know, 3 or 4, when they start to become quote-unquote difficult. They demand a lot, and they cry, or they throw a tantrum, and they just can't hold it, right? They feel overwhelmed. They feel frustrated. They, you know, or maybe it comes up when the child is a teenager, you know, and so it's like not being able to hold their experiences because you can't hold your own experience. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how many women do we hear say, like, oh, teenagers are the worst. It's going to be terrible. Like, you know, it totally doesn't have to be. I'm so ready for that story to be done. And it's simply because they were not held in their experience as young girls. You know, I see this with men too. I mean, even more so with men, I would say, but everyone.
And how do you help the people that you work with sort of uncover and sort of face that trauma that they may have been selectively trying to shove to the back of their subconscious?
I know. And it's like an unconscious intention. I mean, it's just so many women don't even have memories of it until we start talking, and then it's like uncovered, you know, in their 30s or 40s or whatever it is. So what do I do? So we do one-on-one sessions often. I do have a membership, and it's a small group of women, and it's for anybody who wants to come in, no matter where you are. And we just kind of start chatting about these things in a more like casual and curious way. But in one-on-one sessions where it's something, there's an intention to really pinpoint it, I'll just ask them questions. And usually women start to kind of reveal what's coming up for them. And I have studied German New Medicine, and I'm very, very deep in the family systems work of Bert Hellinger. And so those are the two modalities that I use to hold that space for a woman who's recovering the memories or wanting to integrate them. And sometimes it's a few sessions, sometimes it's one session, sometimes I refer them out to someone else who's more specialized in either GNM or family constellations. But usually I'll give them some homework and they will go on a little journey, you know, and I'm always available like to be there when they're working through their process. But I don't really believe, like, I have a lot of experience with CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, like on the receiving end. I'm not a CBT, like for years. I mean, since I'm like 7 years old, you know, was placed in that because of some things that, you know, happened in my family life. And what I started to notice in my teenagers and in my, you know, 20s was like, just like circling the drain. I feel like I'm just talking about the things over and over and over again. And like, you know, forgive and integrate and, you know, but it never really felt like I integrated it. Like I never really felt like I got the tools to understand how the way that I was behaving now was really influencing my body, my health, how it was keeping me in a holding pattern. It was actually, you know, like those connections weren't really made for me, and I wasn't supported in making those connections. And I saw a lot of really, you know, great practitioners, you know, I'm educated and, you know, qualified. And I just felt like it was so much about reliving it and reliving it rather than taking it in and making it a part of me.
Yeah.
And so in these sessions with the women, it's like, we have to drop the rejection. We have to drop the rejection of the past and actually integrate it and begin to embrace it. And I know that sounds so general. What does that really mean? But it's so different for every woman, mm-hmm. you know? And so, yeah, it's something that you don't have to be like, you know, focusing on over and over again, year after year, but something I think to become aware of. And then every step you take in your daily life is with that awareness mm-hmm. and with the acceptance of it.
I remember a couple of months ago, I think I saw something on Instagram from you about how the relationship with the woman's mother really impacts the pregnancy and the birth. And I suspect there are a lot of women out there who have, you know, unresolved tensions with their mother in one way or another. And how do you see that playing out throughout the pregnancy and birth?
Well, it impacts the woman in every area of her life. I mean, I'm reading this incredible book right now called The Primal Wound. As I prepare for this miscarriage masterclass that I'm teaching, because I was in this group discussion with my membership, and I asked the members, I said, you know, if a woman donates her eggs to someone and they grow an embryo and then it's put into a surrogate and she grows the baby for 10 months and then gives it up to someone else, who's the biological mother, right? Is it the woman who donated the eggs? Is it the surrogate who grew the baby for 10 months? Because the baby's amniotic fluid is formed with the mother's cerebral spinal fluid. So cells are being exchanged. Experiences are being had, right? But there's also cells from the egg. So who is the biological mother? And everyone was trying to like solve the puzzle, you know? And so in this book, The Primal Wound, it talks about that. It talks about how those first 10 months of gestation are so important. This is where that initial bond happens. Even if the baby is taken away from the mother at birth, given to an amazing family, they give the baby so much love. The primal wound is there because they've been severed from their life, their life force, the person who grew them, the person that they bonded with, their safety, their rock. You know, and it's kind of a cross-cultural look at adoption, this book. And so I would say that we have so much of that in our society. I mean, it's been around forever. You know, it's not like everyone gets to grow up with their biological mother. Mm-hmm. It's been around, but now it's actually celebrated, supported, and people pay money to do this. And so we have a lot of that. And every woman I've ever talked to who's come from IVF or has been adopted or whatever, they always go on a search for their birth mom, right? They always have that feeling, I need to know, right? And then they feel guilt, you know, but my parents who raised me gave me so much, but I still need to know, who was that? What did she look like? Who was she? Am I like her? Does she want me? Why did she give me up? What was that about? You know, and people think, oh, it's safer to just never tell the child so that they don't grow up confused. But really, there will always be a way. They always know. They will always know. And then what they find out, you know, when they're an adult, and it's like, so, yeah, it's there's that, which is very prevalent in our modern society. And then, of course, women who don't have a lot of support, don't have a lot of containment from their partners or their community. You know, we've all been poisoned by feminism, which has made us believe, don't trust men, get everything that you need, become independent, don't let him pay or else you'll owe him something. Don't let him do that or else you're going to be in debt, right? So there's this whole transactional nature about relationship. And so women have children and then are not able to fully give themselves to their child because they're in this kind of like war zone. In the way that they view relationship and society and men. And it's true. I mean, in many cases, we don't have communities to hold us. You know, we're out of the tribal societies and we're in this, you know, technocratic, very disjointed society. And so then children grow up feeling unattended, right? They have everything they need. They have a roof over their heads. They go to a nice school. They might be playing sports or an instrument and they want for nothing. And they feel completely isolated, disconnected, you know, from their mothers. And they're given a device when they're 8, 9 years old. And so then who becomes their holding? This illusion, the internet, right? That becomes their holding. Mm. And so we're in a really strange place right now. And And so many women, you know, even women who are present at home with their kids are quite disconnected from themselves. And so they can't be present. I had a client recently who, her mother was a stay-at-home mother, but she's also a philanthropist. And she used to bring in foster children. And she used to donate her time at a local shelter. And she used to bring the kids to do the work. And she said, you know, I felt like my mom cared so much more about all of these foster children and, you know, proving herself to be a good citizen and community member at the church. Like, she never saw me. You know, I feel like she never saw me. And I was just kind of like an afterthought because everything looking good to the community and was better, more important to her. Someone else might say, wow, she was such a family woman. And, you know, she's you know, nurture and bringing everybody in. And her kids must have felt so loved because it was just one warm, cozy experience. But that's not what her and her siblings felt at all. They felt a mother who was not present. So I see a lot of that. And how that can then impact the woman is she doesn't feel worthy or doesn't have a blueprint of what it is to be a connected mother. So it impacts her capacity to relate, you know, in relationship and also to procreate and be a mother and find her place in the world, you know, even relate to women and create. And so it's just, there's so much that can influence the way a woman interacts with her world based on her relationship with her mother, you know.
Absolutely.
If women have addict mothers or, you know, substance of, you know, mothers who participate in substance abuse, right? Then they become the caretaker for their mother, right? Because the mother is in a traumatized state, right? And, you know, doing substance abuse. And so that child has to learn to fend for herself. And so then she grows up not being able to really receive love and support to be in a healthy dynamic, usually chooses a partner who is an echo of her mother in a sense, becomes someone she has to care for, someone she has to you know, walk on eggshells around and manage emotionally. And so, of course, that impacts her conception journey. She'll never be contained. She doesn't know what it's like to be contained and safe. So, yeah, our relationship with our mother is something to heal. And that's a lot of what I work on with my clients and talk about in my classes.
I've worked with a fair few practitioners who have essentially realized that they can get people on, you know, the best diet in the best environment, you know, the best sleep. But if they have unresolved trauma, they never make any progress. And something that I've been sort of learning about is this idea of birth trauma. And of course, you don't quite remember it because it's as bad as early on as it gets. But it's still, there's still something deep within your subconscious that sort of remembers that trauma at birth. And I've heard some people being able to revisit it through various modalities. And, you know, when they get there, it's just this huge waterfall of emotions. Very, very visceral sort of unpacking of a trauma they never even knew they had. And I suspect a lot of people, particularly because of the way that, you know, we give birth these days, a lot of people have unresolved birth trauma. And, you know, who knows to what extent that is playing a role in chronic disease and, you know, people dying early. But how do you see this manifesting in people? And are most people aware of the idea of birth trauma when they come to you?
I'd say now most people are aware of birth trauma when they come to me because I talk about it, you know, like I revere it as something that is a significant, player in the way that we end up adulting, relating, you know, and the problem I would say is that most people say kind of what you just said in the beginning, which or earlier when you made this point or you asked this question is like, well, it happened so long ago, but there is a part of me that might remember, right? So it's this idea still that it was so long ago, it's irrelevant now, or, you know, what does a baby know? What does a baby really remember? We just have this concept that because babies can't talk or walk, that they're like dumb balls of matter. They're like these little masses that are, you know, helpless and dumb until they're like, I don't know, 4 or 5 or something. And now they're turning into real people. You know, I feel like the things I hear people say, right? However, when people have done, you know, hypnotic regression or even different types of like breath work practices with the intention of going back to the time of their birth, they've remembered events. They've remembered circumcisions, you know, hours after the birth. They've gotten flashbacks to seeing their parents' face, you know, when they're receiving the circumcision. Their body will go into a freeze state, which is what happens when babies are circumcised. They'll go into a freeze state. And so a lot of, like, I've heard doctors say, like, oh, the baby was so good, he didn't even cry. I'm like, yeah, of course he didn't, because he went into shock. So, well, other babies, like, they might not go into freeze, and they might scream, and they might panic, and, you know, they might have a fever because their body is, like, going into this severe state of reaction. And so I've worked with men who remember that because of different practices that they've engaged in. And so, you know, I see it influence men when it comes to this, you know, their own birth trauma, right? I see it influence women in the sense where, you know, there was the way that the mother is in her own pregnancy impacts the baby. And so there was a woman who said, you know, my mother was contemplating abortion her whole pregnancy with me. She wasn't sure, it wasn't safe, her family didn't know, she went away, you know, saying she was doing this, but nobody, she was pregnant, so she was maybe considering, you know, birthing me, but then giving me up so that she could go back home. I mean, so for the mother to be in that limbo for 10 months, which I can only assume many women, especially, you know, prior to our more modern times, were in that dilemma quite often for fear of being cast out of society or whatever. And so to be in that state of limbo and then being born, you know, having, you know, birthing the baby is not sure if it should come into its body because the mother was not sure about the baby even coming into the world. And so I see a lot of issues with health issues with women who grow up coming from those experiences, from that type of birth trauma, you know, where it's like, I don't know my place in the world. I don't feel I should really be here. Having autoimmune issues, right, where the body is literally, quote, attacking itself, you know. I don't know how this happened. It just started happening, you know. And some people might say, okay, it's vaccine injury. Some people might say other things about how this happens. But if we go back to what the mother's state was when she gave birth to that baby, we can get a lot of information. Even if you can't remember your own birth, you can talk to your mother about what was going on with her in the pregnancy, what was happening with her and your dad, what was happening, you know, did a sudden accident happen? Did, you know, her husband lose his job? Like, were there any events that occurred in that pregnancy? Because that will impact your health, right? Like, if a mother's in a highly adrenalized state under a lot of stress, that's actually going to stress the baby's adrenals, you know, and create issues where it's going to need support after birth, and then it's going to have a lifelong impact. So there's a lot of things that influence that, more so than just taking your prenatal and avoiding alcohol and cigarettes, right? So it's like, it's so much more dynamic. And then, of course, if a woman, you know, has a really traumatic experience, you know, going in for a natural birth and then ending up in an emergency C-section and the baby's being aspirated and there's all this going on, right? The baby's separated from the mother for 4 hours because the mother was under general anesthesia. That baby's being handled by all these strangers, you know, sanitized, bathed, taken, all of this bacteria, it's being stripped away that's protecting it from the environment. And, you know, all of that is incredibly traumatic. And so it's something that our body will hold for a lifetime. And so, you know, the best thing to do if you're considering conceiving at any point, or even if you don't want children, like, I really invite people to go back into that birth experience, you know, and that's something that I can guide people to do. Like, what's the formula for doing that? You know, I'm available to do that because it's so important in learning about yourself.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I know you offer, through your practice is to do with the placenta, and this is something that is, I think, catching on, which is the I think it's the desiccation and encapsulation of the placenta, which the mother then takes. Basically, my basic understanding is to replenish herself and you know, get that back, because it's quite a large mass that comes out that's obviously all come from her body. First of all, how long should, in your opinion, how long should the placenta be attached before the cord is cut? And yeah, we'll start with that.
Yeah, well, personally, I did what for my birth, I did like a half lotus, which is basically I left the placenta, the cord, and the baby attached for about 5 hours until I was like, okay, it's bedtime and I'm not doing a full lotus, which means that you would leave the placenta attached to the baby via the cord until it dries, until the cord literally dries and shrivels and it detaches on its own organically, which involves curing the placenta with salt and herbs, changing the dressings every day so that the placenta doesn't rot. But then you can't consume the placenta. And I wanted to consume the placenta, so I did the half lotus, which, you know, it's like a piece of fresh meat, right? It's like buying lamb. It's like it can be refrigerated for a week or so. It's not going to go bad. So it was just out, you know, in a glass container. And then at that point, the specialist took it and she encapsulated it, which is a process of draining most of as much of the blood out as you can from the organ, removing the amniotic sac, you know, dehydrating that separately, which is filled with stem cells. And then slicing the placenta thinly, dehydrating that, you know, first at 165 degrees is typically, you know, what you do for a few hours, and then you bring it down to 115 degrees. And then when it's finished dehydrating, you pulverize it and encapsulate it. I do recommend that women take a piece of the placenta immediately, just a you know, maybe a 2-inch piece, and consume it immediately after the birth. Because that's going to support. It's an old tradition to help women stop the bleeding and to help actually contract the uterus so that it starts to shrink back down to its size. And so it's a really great way to deal with hemorrhage as well, is to immediately take a big piece of the placenta and swallow it. Or you can take part of the amniotic sac. You can put it on the side of your mouth between your teeth and your cheek and hold it there. So that's the way that women used to resolve, you know, excessive bleeding. Before we had chemicals like Pitocin, which doesn't always work. But yeah, that's kind of the process. And women take the capsules. You know, they might take a piece of the raw placenta and then the rest two capsules. Some women put it in smoothies. In different cultures, they've created pâtés or broths from it. There are some cultures and religions where, you know, they don't consume the placenta, but they will bury it. There's always, you know, historically been an honoring of the organ. I've never, in all my years, research, reading, conversations, I've never heard of anyone just throwing it away and considering it to be waste, which is what hospitals do now, apparently, which I also know that hospitals do keep the placentas and sell them. So it's it's definitely, you know, a placenta is worth $50,000 US, you know, if we're looking at what it can offer for stem cell medicines, like for sports therapy and things like that. I know in the cosmetic industry, they use, you know, sheep placentas for various applications. Mm-hmm. I've had clients who've asked for their placenta to be dehydrated, encapsulated, and then they ship it to family members who are doing plastic surgery in other countries so that they can actually use that as part of their, it's like people are doing all kinds of things with their placenta, but it's their right to do so because it belongs to them, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they grew it, it's their property. And so for people, you know, the conventional medical system to say, well, you can't do that, you know, but who are they to say that? It has nothing to do with them in the same way that it's their baby, you know. People want to eat it, they can eat it. They want to bury it, they can bury it. You know, if they want to throw it away, they can too. But I don't recommend that. If you're not going to consume it, also just at least honor it as something that gave your baby, like it was what sustained your baby's life for 10 months, you know. In many cultures, they called it the first mother because that's what the baby was looking at, you know, throughout the pregnancy. And that's the sound of the whooshing in the cord through the placenta is also what they heard apart from their mother's own heartbeat. So it's a pretty incredible organ, you know, filled with iron, stem cells. It's just a really great way to replenish after the birth.
Yeah. I know some cultures, I read in Western A. Price's work, some cultures make the woman wait about 3 years before conceiving again because they realize how long it takes to replenish the body after giving birth. Yes.
Yeah.
And some women are having, children year after year after year.
Yeah.
It just absolutely drains them to the point where, you know, they become unwell because they've given basically everything to the children. What is your view on the current vaccination schedule?
I don't believe in vaccines at all. So as far as the schedule goes, I mean, I think that there's people who are in an outrage about how closely, you know, they're expecting their children to get vaccinated, right? You know, every month, every few months, and this amount before the age of 18, you know, it's criminal, right? They should spread it out. But, like, it's an illusion that spreading it out even makes a difference. I would say, you know, if someone is looking at delayed, it's hard to have conversations with people who would believe in the schedule anyway. I mean, it's just where they're at, as far as how they view health and the immune system and cells and bacteria. It's it's a whole perspective shift, that someone would have to make. But I think the people who are kind of in that in between where it's they're open to alternative ways of doing things, but they're, you know, still have one foot in a fear grid, you know, I would say just look at where that's coming from. I think there's more opportunity there to kind of assess how we view our health and how we view healing, right? Because it's people who are I eat this and I don't eat that and I would never do that. And I, you know, unplug my Wi-Fi at night and I put EMF protectors on this, but we're doing the vaccines, but they're doing them spread out and delayed. And so there's just a lot of duality and I'd say a divided will there. So that's the bigger thing to look at. I've never seen any benefit come from vaccinations, but I know that a lot of the programming that we've had collectively as a society is that major illnesses were, you know, were mitigated or prevented, polio being one of them, which, you know, no one ever talks about how polio is really resolved, right? And, you know, how polio actually happens. They think it was because of a vaccine. And so it's hard to deprogram ourselves. It's really hard to deprogram ourselves. But I've seen enough children injured from vaccines, you know, with my own eyes in real time that I just don't even consider, you know, I don't even consider them as part of my rhetoric in my life. They just don't exist. They just don't exist.
Yeah, it's interesting how how not getting vaccinated is the alternative path when really that is not the alternative path. That's the regular path, the normal path. One other thing that sort of troubles me is the amount of young mothers who have trouble breastfeeding and the reliance on formula that I understand it is a bit of an issue. Some women genuinely do struggle and have to rely on formula. But I think the literature is extremely clear that formula does not provide even close to the benefit of breast milk. And, you know, how do you help women, how do you help them get to the point where they can breastfeed for as long as they feel like they need to without the issues that a lot of women face?
Well, a lot of the issues that women face when it comes to breastfeeding are because of the way that they birthed. And so it's one of the main factors. And so if a woman has had a traumatic birth experience, it's going to be very difficult for her to step into breastfeeding.
Right.
Especially if she's separated from the baby or she's recovering from a C-section, breastfeeding is not easy. It's not an easy thing to do. You know, it's a learned skill. There's a learning curve and it's a full-time commitment. We as women, kind of going back to what I said earlier, are in a state of survival. There's an unconscious, you know, state of survival. And that also just comes with being a human. We're animals, right? So we're always surviving. I mean, we're trying to make a living to survive. Like, it's just, it's inherent in our existence. However, women more so, because they feel so kind of torn by all of the obligations that they've created from themselves to survive. You know, a lot of them say, like, I'm educated, I went to college, I invested money and resources into, you know, this degree and then the master's and then the this and then this job. And, you know, so many people would want it, that they already have set themselves up for a lifestyle that doesn't support what it takes to breastfeed. So there's that factor as well. Or they have partners that, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of relationships where it's 50-50 financially. And so 50-50, and on top of it, the woman is expected to breastfeed and stay at home sometimes and also make the home and also be a wife and also keep her health going. And so it's not possible. If a woman attempts to do all those things, they're all going to be at 30%. All of them will suffer. And so you can't have it all in that sense, but it's not about having it all either. You know, it's not about, like, what's the magic trick that'll make it all work, you know? And so women end up hiring nannies thinking that they can't have it all, or putting them in daycare, and you can't breastfeed like that, where you're stuck pumping milk to put it in a bottle so someone else can do it, so you can go to work, so you can pay for the person who's bottle feeding your baby. Like, it's just madness. And so I would say, apart from having a traumatic birth experience, on top of it, we haven't set ourselves up within our family to be in the role of a breastfeeder.
Yeah.
And so, and then we look at nutrition, and then we look at habits, and then, you know, there's all these other things coming after that, but those are the two main issues standing in the way between a woman and having successful breastfeeding.
Do you think if there are women who are currently struggling with breastfeeding, do you think that there are things that they could do to turn that around rather quickly?
I mean, it depends on where they're at in their journey, because I think a lot of women are like, I'll breastfeed for a few months and then I'm switching over. And so being in that state of apprehension, right, anticipation, okay, this is going to change, it's really hard, you know. So if you're still in that point where you're like, it's going to change in a while because I'm going to have to do this, look at the options of getting the support that you need. You know, what does that look like? And it's hard. It's, you know, to be a single mom, for example, breastfeeding is probably impossible, like nearly impossible. I don't know many women who are single moms and working who successfully breastfed, mm-hmm. unless they're getting full financial support from, you know, the father of the baby. You know, there's certain arrangements that are made and work for some people, but for the most part, it's really hard. And then we look at, you know, couples. So it's like, how can you shift your entire lifestyle, if this is that important to you, how do you shift your entire lifestyle so that there is spaciousness for you to breastfeed, right? And if it's really hard the first few days, you need a lactation consultant. We didn't grow up watching women breastfeed. That's pretty much been gone extinct in our society, in our generation. We don't live in multi-generational households anymore, where we're growing up watching, you know, our aunts breastfeed, our cousins, you know, that's something of the old world.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe in the East, it's still like that. I have clients, you know, come from India or the Middle East, and, you know, it's still here and there, perhaps, but not really. Pretty much every family is living in their own little cubicle, you know, their own unit separated from family. So women don't grow up, little girls don't grow up watching other women breastfeed. So they need to learn. And that often requires paying someone, or going to your local WIC office, your government office, and speaking with a lactation consultant and resolving the bumps in the road so that you can then have a longer breastfeeding journey. But giving up in those first few days, that's where we set ourselves up for failure, because sometimes it's something we can correct pretty easily. We just need the guidance and the support. And then, of course, women are like, okay, well, I'm going to give the baby a pacifier. I'm going to put the baby in a crib. There's so many things we do that are mistaken that get in the way of us successfully breastfeeding. But we don't think so, because there's a whole baby industry advertising all this garbage that makes it more convenient to be a mother. And so we get all this stuff, and then it actually backfires and it makes breastfeeding harder. It makes our connection with our baby harder to achieve.
Are there any, you know, maybe like a few books that you recommend people read, you know, mothers and fathers or expecting mothers and fathers, to, you know, get an understanding of you know, how they can make this process as good as they possibly can? Are there some really good books that you recommend?
Yes. I can send them to you and you can put them in the show notes if you'd like. But
yeah, that would be great.
Off the top of my head, Act of Birth by Janet Belaskis is a great book. It's like essential. There's a book, you know, the Womanly Art of Breastfeeding, which is from La Leche League, which unfortunately La Leche League just announced that they're officially woke and they don't use the word woman anymore. They use breastfeeding person. They use chest feeding instead of breastfeeding. They've completely like abandoned the sanctity of what it is to be a woman, and they've subscribed to this greater agenda. So the book, get your copy now, because who knows when they're going to update the version and remove the word woman, which is quite unfortunate. So I do for now recommend that book. It was great. I recommend it to my students and my doula training as well. I'll send you a list. There's a few other ones that are going to be game changing. There's Husband Coach Childbirth by Dr. Bradley. That's a great book for men to read. The language is a little bit like outdated, and he's a Christian, so he speaks a lot about that. So I don't mind that at all, but some people might not connect to it, but it's a great book for men. He uses the word baby box instead of uterus, so he's very delicate with his language. Not because he's like on some agenda, he was just trying to be polite. That's an excellent book for men.
That's fantastic. I will make sure I put all of the links to everything else that you're doing as well in the notes so that people can find you and connect with you. I'll be cautious of your time. I know you're probably busy. I will leave you to it, but I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing some of your wisdom. This is something I like doing podcasts where I almost know nothing about it because I learn the most. So this has been a fantastic experience. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Cameron. I actually am curious to know, what your perception of birth, like, has been pretty much your whole life. It seems like it was influenced a lot by your own experience with your mother.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not something I thought of until I started to get into, health, because I was a very sickly child. It was my real understanding of birth was, my mother's 36-hour labor before the doctor decided, oh, let's do, he wanted her to do a breech birth. And then finally changed his mind at the end and said, no, let's do an emergency C-section. My mum very, very much almost died. She got very, very sick afterwards. I almost died. I was very, very sick. My mum wanted more kids, I think. But after that, my dad was like, absolutely not. It was kind of... And it was funny because my sister, who was born 2 years prior, was like the easiest birth ever. Like, no dramas whatsoever. It's not something I had thought about until, the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. But it's been something I've been very passionate about trying to work towards getting right for myself, because I don't want my children to come into the world like that. I want to give them the best start possible. So learning about all of this now has become very important to me. Like you said, we're basically taught that the hospitals take care of everything. Just do whatever the doctors say. They have your best interests at heart. And, I work in a hospital. I know it's a business first. Yeah, it's always a business first. And I don't believe that they have our best interests at heart all the time. And it's not because the doctors are bad people. It's just because the system is so messed up that it's the people don't come first.
And there's so much protocol to follow. There's legalities, there's politics. I mean, there's so much more at play, and it's about saving a life. It's not about the road to saving the life or the quality of the experience. It's like, we will do whatever it takes to save your life. That's the goal. We want as many live people walking out of this hospital as possible. So it doesn't matter what we have to do to this woman to get there.
Yeah. And I was reading on your website, the erythromycin treatment for infant dies directly after birth as a prophylactic. It's like, how many people are aware that that's going on? And I believe vitamin K injections happen like directly after
birth. There's within the first hour after the birth, there are a series of newborn procedures that will change the course of that human's life forever. Yeah. I mean, people have performed circumcisions without even consulting the parents. I mean, that's how crazy it is, right? Which, you know, it's fine. People circumcise, do whatever they want. But a lot of people just don't even know what's happening. And then they inject them. So women say to me, I don't know if they injected the baby with vitamin K, right? And a lot of them didn't even know what vitamin K was. They thought it was a vitamin, right? Which is not. It's like an extremely dangerous chemical that coagulates the blood, you know? So it's like...
Yeah, and it's got a very nasty warning on the package insert that no one ever gets read. Even the nurses generally don't know about the dangers of it.
Exactly. And it's quite powerful. You've had that birth experience because had you not, right, you wouldn't have been compelled to go down this path of truth and education, right? And there could have been the perpetuation of a cycle of really disconnected and conscious births and experiences in your lineage, right? And so it's just, not to say that that's what happened with your sister, but there's a rupture in the story for this purpose.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite perfect.
I'm very grateful for the troubles that I've had with my health, because without them, I probably wouldn't have set myself up in this way. I definitely wouldn't have. It's something to be grateful for, and not to be resentful about, because it's only going to benefit my children and the people around me for sure.
Yeah, it's part of the greater awakening process, you know. And awakening's not easy all the time.
What a great way to wrap up.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to meet you and speak with you.
After we finished recording, Isla and I discussed how those with tribal tattoos note that the pain of the tattoos is necessary for their significance. Something I always felt was reflected in the pain of childbirth. I regret not recording this discussion, as it was paramount to where we were going with the whole conversation, that the greatest of gifts are gained through the greatest of sacrifices, something women are intimately and uniquely connected to with their responsibility of childbirth. So thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed the conversation. I've left all of Isla's links in the episode notes if you want to follow her work or connect with her. I've also recently started a Substack where I share my ideas that go beyond the scope of these podcasts and get deeper into information that can be directly used to understand the foundations of health. I've also been working very closely with Kira Lee and Dr. Jalal Khan on the Quantum Health Academy. This is an education platform where we will be teaching about a new science of life, one focused on everything the centralized medical system fails to address. So please feel free to check this project out. I'll have more news on this soon. I've also left links to all of my other social media platforms if you want to keep up with the podcast. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.